Welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, the Pharmacist's Cardiovascular Digest from Pharmacy Times. As always, I'm your host, Craig Devers. This is a solo episode. As you may be aware, the American Heart Association meeting is coming up in the next few weeks. And I wanted to give a little space and time for people to be engaged with this as I bring on different guests. Furthermore, I'm planning a couple different series over the next several months to include some different perspectives or different disease states. So for example, I'm working on getting a episode or episodes on hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And so if you're wondering, why didn't he cover this trials from the European Society of Cardiology meeting related to those studies? Well, there's a specific reason and method to the madness for this. And so those will be coming out in the next several months. Furthermore, I'm working on or trying to put together a series of content around amyloid or amyloid cardiomyopathy related to that disease state. So that would be coming down the line. So just stay tuned for this. And as I alluded just a moment ago, in the next two episodes or the next episode after this one, we're going to be talking or planning for what the American Heart Association meeting is going to bring and kind of do something similar we did with the European Society of Cardiology and dig into those things. Some other housekeeping items that are on the docket. I would like for you to also make sure that you are liking and subscribing if you do like our content. I still would love for people to reach out and provide feedback or commentary or what they're interested in seeing. I'm also still looking for some different patient perspectives. I know I have one potentially planned for the amyloid series that we're doing. But if you have patients or interest to share your experience, please let me know. You can email me or you can send me a social media contact via X, LinkedIn, whatever media form that you have. But again, please like, help us with the algorithm, give us stars, ratings. If you do give us a rating, I'll try to read them online. And I appreciate your support as we do this and continue to do this and hopefully continue to make it meaningful and valuable. And then some other new things that we're going to be doing. I'm trying to come up with some fun ways to make the content a little bit different than a normal podcast and have some ideas. And then we're going to be doing some video series coming up that you'll see myself and my guests communicating with each other. And then we're talking about doing a live stream at the American Heart Association meeting. From that standpoint, please stay tuned. We're trying to keep growing and making this better. But now let's get to the content. And so in this solo episode, I'm going to dig into two different articles that have come out more recently. One being the paper that is describing the adipokinon hypothesis of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And then another that talks about, or it's a scientific statement talking about inflammation and cardiovascular disease. And just kind of a little bit of a different flavor of an episode, where we're not necessarily talking about trials per se, but maybe some things mechanistically related to the disease states and how pharmacists can go through this and talk about the evidence. And so I want to dig into this first provocative new hypothesis in heart failure, one that may reframe how we think heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HFpEF, and explore its implications for clinicians, pharmacists, and researchers. And again, the paper that I'm referring to you is the adipokinon hypothesis of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. This was published in JACC, and you'll see the links below and some maybe other resources. And we'll walk through the core ideas, the strengths and limitations, and then I'll comment on what it might mean for clinical care, drug development, and the role of the pharmacist in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So let's get started on this first paper. So a little background of why this matters. And before diving into the article, I want to set the stage that heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, or HFpEF, has long been a therapeutic and scientific challenge for the management in this space. And despite progress in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or HFrEF, HFpEF remains more heterogeneous with multiple proposed pathophysiologic pathways. You know, when I think about that, I think about what other comorbidity burdens or microvascular dysfunction that could be contributing to this, fibrosis, myocardial stiffening, systemic inflammation, really the milieu of all these things together that lead to it. And what is the things that are implementing or contributing to this and leading to this? One barrier is that we lack a unifying or dominant mechanistic paradigm. And I think this is both important from the concept of development of therapeutic processes, but also really how we approach the disease states, how we communicate it to patients, et cetera. And different patients may have different drivers because of this lack of unification or multifactorial pathophysiologic processes. So things like hypertension, obesity, metabolic dysfunction, renal comorbidity, amyloidosis, et cetera. If we think some of that, as we've alluded to before, some of those contributors are the cardiokidney metabolic paradigm. And as a result, treatments have had mixed success and trial design is tricky. How do you enroll and target the right subgroup? Because it is so heterogeneous in the process. And so it makes it really challenging. In this new JACC paper, and this paper you could argumentatively say is an extension of the European Society of Cardiology coverage because it was kind of published during that time. And related to that. And it argues that the adipokines hypothesis that bioactive mediators released from the adipose tissue might serve as the central integrator of systemic and cardiac derangements in HFpEF. So in other words, they propose that adipose, heart signaling axis, via adipokines could unify many of the comorbidity-mediated pathways in HFpEF. So in more practical terms, this is interesting because it's saying adipose tissue is a pervasive, dynamic, and modifiable, and this is through weight loss, through either, you know, lifestyle changes, GLP-1s, et cetera, and metabolic therapy, perhaps pharmacological targeting has alluded to. And so if the adipokines really are central, then we might find new biomarkers, drug targets, and risk stratification tools. So I want to walk you through some of the core hypotheses that are derived from this paper, and hopefully it'll get your brain thinking about this. So the authors propose that many HFpEF patients have expansion of adipose tissue, especially in their visceral adiposity or ectopic fat, and this leads to dysregulated adipokine secretion. And these adipokines include leptin, adiponecetin, resentin, camarin, others. That are known or less studied, and possibly new discovered mediators that we haven't understood yet. And these adipokines, in turn, act on the vascular myocardium, kidneys, and endothelial interferences to drive microvascular dysfunction, low-grade inflammation, fibrosis, altered energy metabolism, endothelial to mesenchymal transition, and myocardial stiffness. And moreover, they suggest a feed-forward loop. As a cardiac and systemic effect worsens, they may further promote adipose inflammation and dysfunction and creating a vicious cycle. And this will be interesting because the next paper we're going to talk about focuses a little bit about inflammation and how they're kind of looped or linked. And the authors contrast the adipokine hypothesis with alternative models, you know, models that we've maybe historically thought about in heart failure, either purely hemodynamic loading and unloading, comorbidity spillover, meaning this is just a consequence of the comorbidities, when really maybe the central driver is this adiposity process, and arguing that these adipose-derived signaling can integrate and mediate many of those comorbid effects. They also propose a conceptual framework for how to test this hypothesis, which is great because, again, if you think back of how we've thought about HFpEF, we've really not had that central domain, and that's where you get such a mixed picture. It's heterogeneous. It's almost like when you think about acute decompensated heart failure trials, acute decompensated heart failure is such a heterogeneous process that the data and doing good trials are significantly harder. And this is the same thing that maybe you've thought about or we've thought about with HFpEF, but this would provide a centralized framework, you know, using biomarkers that we know or discover. You know, what are the mechanistic studies or the interventional models like weight loss or metabolic modulation and stratified trials to help understand or figure out what we need to do. And this model is very ambitious, speculative, but it is potentially unifying and it is great to put a framework. Again, it is the centralized conceit that we've not thought about. And it really is a paradigm maybe to reframe that work. And obviously we have a lot of work to do and go in this, but I think about this more pertinently clinically, and I'll talk about this as a pharmacist in a minute, but it really does make me think differently about how I'm approaching these patients and what I need to do for them or recommend or treat with them. So what are the strengths with this or the novelties? And so really, it is an integrative view. And so the adipokine axis might unify disparate mechanistic trends. So when we look at metabolic inflammatory endothelial remodeling from that standpoint, and it kind of is a unification in the field. It's nice because it has testability, because adipose tissue is modifiable. This hypothesis is more amenable to translational and interventional testing than the current mechanisms or thoughts that we have. And so as we think about weight loss or bariatric surgery or metabolic drugs such as GLP-1s, SGLT2 inhibitors, or other novel adipokine agents, that are in there that could be tested for causality. And it does help us either use current biomarkers or look for particular biomarkers that are related to adipose, related mediators, or correlate with disease progression. So this is very, very exciting since it's a new area of development and growth. So what are the caveats or the challenges? This is, you know, really a balance or a battle of causality versus association. So many adipokines are associated with obesity and cardiovascular risk, but demonstrate causal upstream influence versus downstream epiphenomenons. It is hard to really to demonstrate the benefit or the upstream versus downstream effects of this. And then HFpEF, distinguishing cause and effect is very, very tricky from that standpoint. There is phenotypic heterogeneity, and this has always been a problem with HFpEF and why the frame, the tenet gives it a unifying standpoint. There is still such phenotypic heterogeneity in HFpEF as a whole as a syndrome because there are multiple phenotypes, and we know that. Will this hypothesis apply to all HFpEF or only the subset that are the obese or metabolic phenotype? And I think that's where it gets tricky because we do know there are reasons for HFpEF to be driven, maybe for some instances that are not metabolic and phenotypic. And our whole series on amyloid, we'll talk about this because that's probably quite different. And it's probably the latter that this may be layered in and still takes to the construct of we need to continually get better at precision-based medicine and understanding what how to manipulate or pick the right patient. So, for example, when you think about an agent about GLP-1, you're going to be like, okay, these are the phenotypes that match this, and this is the treatment that would be best for those patients. And then again, furthermore, if you had genetics or other pieces or other biomarkers, that would be helpful. So there is redundancy and compensation. So biological signaling is redundant. Even if one adipokine is modulated, others may be compensated. What's more is the myocardium and the vascular have multiple other inputs, so such as neurohormonal, local mechanical stress, and aging, and may dilute or override the adipokine effects. And then we're going to have measurement issues. So how do you get reliable, reproducible measurements of novel adipokines is not trivial, or it's not new. You know, we haven't really mastered that process. And so some may be tissue specific, some may be low abundance, some may be unstable. So we have a lot of work to do in this field in terms of biomarkers and what we're going to do with this and how we're going to use it and translating this into true mechanistic studies. And then furthermore, extending upon that to implementation science is going to be a long journey and a very important one to look at or use as a hypothesis or to test this. And then there's interventional safety. So modulation of adipokines may have off-target effects like metabolic or immunologic that are unpredicted. So in short, the hypothesis is very provocative. It is very fertile for future study. So all you researchers out there that are listening and are interested in this, I think this is a great domain to look at. And it doesn't, you know, dethrone other complementary pathways, but it does make you think about things differently. And so why is this hypothesis kind of there in the putting on the context? Let me pull some strands from the broader literature. So we know one, and kind of I alluded to this, obesity and HFpEF has associations. There are several epidemiologic and mechanistic studies that have long showed obesity, especially visceral adiposity, is a risk factor for HFpEF, even after controlling for hypertension and other comorbidities. Adiposity is associated with worse diastolic dysfunction, higher left atrial pressures, microvascular dysfunction, fibrosis, systemic inflammation. Again, the systemic inflammation often leads to the fibrosis. And this existing linkage gives plausibility to the adipose mediators playing a role. And then we know weight loss and metabolic interventions have been helpful. And that's the barrage of data that we're seeing that are coming out in some of our newer trials. And that clinical mechanistic data, some from bariatric surgery, which is not as good, maybe some low cardiac diet, but really the GLP-1 agonists and even some of our work with SGLT2s that suggest that weight loss leads to improvement in cardiac structure and function that reduces left ventricular mass, improved diastolic parameters. These improvements may correlate with reductions in inflammation that we've talked about and we're going to talk about in a minute, or adipose and derived signaling. So the upstream manipulation of adipose affects cardiac outcomes and kind of supports a reverse evidence process. So it's like we already see the end game now with some of our data that exists. If you think about the STEP HFpEF trials, if you think about what we're seeing in some of the data, even when you talk about the renal data with flow, But when you talk about SURMOUNT and other studies that have come out with tirzepatide and semaglutide, you can see that reverse process. So adipokine biology and cardiovascular disease. So outside of HFpEF, adipokines have been studied in atherosclerosis, hypertension, metabolic syndrome, and heart failure. And for instance, leptin is a pro-hypertensive, pro-oxidant adiponectin in general, and that is generally protective. It has anti-inflammatory and insulin-sensitizing properties. However, in human heart failure, adipokine levels are often altered, though their prognostic and messing roles are not fully consistent across studies, and some have paradoxical association in advanced heart disease or disease states. And then precision phenotyping clustering HFpEF. Contemporary HFpEF trialists have recognized that a one-size-fits-all approach fails, and we see that very clearly. And if you look at any reviews or literatures in terms of what is HFpEF and so forth, you can tell that there's different phenotypes and drivers. And the phenogroup clustering, so obese metabolic phenotype, a renal dysfunction phenotype, or vascular stiffening phenotype is emerging. In that context, this is where the hypothesis might strongly fit or apply or see that the obese metabolic clusters. And it really does fit into this construct, as I've talked before, or as you keep me hearing promoting or thinking about the cardio-kidney metabolic syndrome. I think that is where we see from a valid standpoint. And that, in my mind, not just talks about the mechanistic ownership of the disease state, but it goes to things like social determinants of health, breaking down silos and barriers from a strategy standpoint, and really thinking about how we all must have ownership in the management of this disease state to help actually move the needle and the progress, and thinking about implementation strategies. And then the fifth thing is there's parallel proposals and alternative unifying models. So other researchers proposed that microvascular endothelial dysfunction, systemic inflammation, and renal cardiac crossover may be central. So this new paper in JACC may be seen as adding to evolving paradigm shift from viewing HFpEF as a diastolic dysfunction alone, which I think we've really moved away from that for a long time now, in my opinion, or I don't think of it that way, to recognizing this is a multi-system, multi-metabolic inflammatory syndrome with adipose signaling as a potential central hub for certain phenotypes. So just think about that. Now, in my view, so what? What are the implications, especially for us pharmacists and other clinicians? I think the role is, what does risk stratification and biomarkers look like? So if adipokine signatures or adipose drive mediators panels become validated or available, pharmacists may be interpreting, ordering, or integrating those biomarkers with other cardiovascular risk markers. For example, if a patient with obesity, hypertension, and early diastolic dysfunction has elevated pro-adipokine risk score, that might trigger earlier intervention. Therapeutic targeting, trauma, and future HFpEF trials enrollment may be enriched by this particular phenotype. Patients with high risk adipokine profiles may be preferentially included in trials of metabolic or adipose targeting therapies, and pharmacists can be involved in the trial design or clinical research or implementation and may advocate for this type of stratification. And then the metabolic and weight management therapies has GLP-1 receptors, SGLT2 inhibitors, and other metabolic modulators like dual agonists or adipokine modulators become more widely used. The potential benefit downstream effects on cardiac structure and function may be partially mediated via adipokine normalization. And pharmacists play a role in optimizing and monitoring these therapies, especially in those with early HFpEF risk. And then there's prevention holistic care for patients with obesity, metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, hypertension, really the CKM paradigm, but those without overt heart failure. And I think about these being our stage zeros and ones and twos, recognizing that adipose tissue are not just a passive fat store, but an active endocrine organ reinforces the importance of early lifestyle, dietary, physical activity, and pharmacologic interventions. You think of Life Simple 8. And again, this feeds directly into the AHA cardio-kidney metabolic paradigm of stage 0, 1, 2, and 3. And we'll have more guidelines about this. And of course, our primary prevention guidelines are being updated next year as well. And these preventions become upstream. And I refer you back to the statement I was an author on with HFSA and the Cardiac Prevention Society that talks about the same construct. And there was actually a similar article published at the European Society of Cardiology in Lancet that talks about these paradigms. It is very much here now. And then there's challenges in translation. As I mentioned earlier, translation from mechanistic hypotheses to clinical tools is always fraught. And pharmacists engage in translational research need to stay alert for validation of new biomarkers, assay standardization, safety signals from that standpoint. So that's that. That's the first article. The second article I want to talk about is this other article in JACC in 2025, and we'll put, it's a scientific statement that we'll put in the title or in the notes, entitled Inflammation, Cardiovascular Disease. And this synthesizes decades of evidence linking inflammation with cardiovascular risk. And we've talked about inflammation above with the hypothesis and how important that is. And this goes specifically to the inflammation component of this. And I know we've all talked or thought about inflammation, but it's nice to see where we've been, what's emerging, where the gaps are. And so for years, inflammation was viewed as the consequence of atherosclerosis, a bystander. And we actually recognize now it's the active driver. And I've always thought about this in terms of, if you really think about atherosclerotic plaque development and formation, really inflammation is a key player in this. It leads to that destabilization, even the progression of heart failure and arrhythmias. And in the paper, they summarize a pivotal shift. Cardiovascular disease is not just a lipid disorder. It's an inflammatory disease with metabolic, immune, and vascular dimensions. And the statement revisits decades of epidemiology, from CRP or C-reactive protein to IL-6 studies to the clinical proof of concept by CANTOS, which is a trial where canakinumab reduced recurrent events independent of LDL lowering. And beyond that, we've seen anti-inflammatory benefits from colchicine and the Clocot and the Lodo-CoV-2, with low-dose colchicine confirming that inflammation is not just a marker, it's a modifiable target. So the statement organizes inflammation's role across four mechanistic domains: atherogenesis and plaque rupture, which is driven by monocyte activation, NLRP3, inflammasome signaling, and IL-1 beta and IL-6 cascades. It then talks about microvascular and endothelial dysfunction, which we talk about often in cardiovascular disease, and leaking systemic inflammation to impaired nitric oxide bioavailability and oxidative stress. And if you've done anything in cardiovascular disease or studied cardiovascular disease, the nitric oxide pathway is so important, or so often brought up as a process or the impairment of that. And so you can see this link with inflammation. Myocardial remodeling, where chronic inflammation accelerates fibrosis and ventricular dysfunction. And so we've talked about, if you think about HFpEF and you think about the mechanism of regulation with MRAs or mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, or how they work, the downstream consequences of this fibrosis and remodeling, that is the true benefit. This anti-inflammatory process is so key in changing the messenger RNA and the process there that prevents that downstream process. Then the last thing is systemic comorbid amplification, where metabolic disease, infection, and autoimmune activity perpetuate inflammation or inflammatory cardiovascular injury. A critical addition is the recognition of residual inflammatory risk. Patients were with well-controlled LDL but persistently elevated inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein greater than 2 milligrams per deciliter who remain at risk. And this is when you look at the current, and we'll see what the new guidelines say, but when you look at the cholesterol guidelines from 2018, this is where they stage people higher, even if they are considered moderate risk. For example, if you have other risk factors like elevated inflammatory markers or disease states of inflammatory, that you can get higher residual risk and try to mitigate those factors. And there's a therapeutic sweet spot where pharmacists may see inflammation target therapies used wide or adjunctively. The authors also emphasize that CRP, IL-6, and GlycoA, but emerge also new molecular signatures, including transcriptomorphic and proteonomic inflammation panels under development. However, they stress a key caution: no single biomarker should yet guide therapy at this particular juncture, and you use those things together with your information at this point to make decisions. So from a pharmacist standpoint, this means don't overinterpret CRP in isolation. And that's one thing I always caution people about: use it as a marker and a piece of information, but don't use it alone. And contextualize inflammation with lipid control, comorbidities, and residual risk. So like I think about it as like, if they have this and some other things, I'm going to think higher risk patients and do additional things. And prepare for future integration of inflammatory biomarkers in the cardiovascular risk algorithms. And we're kind of seeing that already. Again, it'll be interesting to see as the CKM guidelines come out, as we see the new cholesterol guidelines. So we have other agents that are coming down the pipeline, what we're going to do with this, and as we get better algorithms. And interestingly, the statement also revisits infection-driven inflammation, including the lingering cardiovascular risk of COVID and COVID chronic viral activation, suggesting a broader immunometabolic model of CVD. And this is interesting. This has been explored for lots of times. If you look back at some of the old cardiovascular trials, you see some studies where they looked at maybe putting floxacin antibiotic agents as a part of the 2x2 factorial design of clinical trials, and really using to look at the control of bacteria to control the inflammatory risk. Like, this is not a new concept. I think we're continuing to refine this as a process. Now, the question everybody asks is, what can we do about inflammation? And really, there are three things. We can establish agents with anti-inflammatory benefits. So colchicine, like Colcot and Lodoco, has modest but consistent MACE, major adverse cardiac event reduction. Statins are not just lipid lowering, they dampen vascular inflammation. That has been proven from our earlier trials. If you think about Jupiter, that was done with rosuvastatin, from that standpoint, or you think or all of our atorvastatin studies, such as PROVE-IT, as you think about several of our larger studies at that particular standpoint. But Jupiter definitely looked at a primary prevention trial with rosuvastatin and used C-reactive protein to look at vascular inflammation from that standpoint. And then SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, which have pleiotropic, anti-inflammatory, and endothelial effects. The second is targeting anti-cytokine therapies. So can necutamab or an IL-1B blocking agent prove the concept in CANTOS, but is limited by its infection risk and it's super expensive. And then we have other IL-6 inhibitors such as zelovecumab, and which we'll see in the RESCUE and the ZEUS programs. It shows promise, but we need large outcome trials. And then emerging metabolic inflammatory modulators, therapies targeting NLRP3, CRP inhibition, and oxidative stress pathways. And it highlights that we can, again, like we talked about in the article above, precise inflammatory targeting is likely the next frontier. So what is the role for pharmacists? It's really, the role is four areas. We're going to see risk stratification. I think you should think about inflammatory risk and residual inflammatory risk after LDL lowering and thinking about that in flag candidates, either for emerging therapies or who you're going to further risk stratify up. You know, medication optimization, ensure adherence to foundational cardiometabolic therapies. And this is so key right now and so important, that lower inflammation, making sure patients are on or taking their statins, on or taking their SGLT2 inhibitors, on or taking their GLP-1 agents, their ACE inhibitors, or ARBs, or ARNIs. For monitoring for colchicine and biologics, we must make sure that we limit infection risk or myelosuppression or drug interaction. So that is always going to be a key role for pharmacists, especially in the community setting or in the clinic setting. And then patient education, helping patients understand that inflammation is a modified driver of disease and not just a background marker, empowering lifestyle and adherence behaviors and reducing systemic inflammation, weight loss and exercise and stopping smoking. Stop doing the things that are going to create inflammation, weight loss. What exercise that improves those things, smoking cessation, proper sleep hygiene, removing depression, improving environmental aspects, so improving social determinants of health. So there are several research gaps that we still have to work through as a community, so that standardizing inflammatory biomarker thresholds for risk stratification, understanding long-term safety and cost and efficacy for chronic inflammation blockade, and again, as I've already said, understanding social determinants of health and environmental exposures and inflammation frameworks. This is where the concept of immunometabolic precision of cardiology, so it goes to what I was saying in the last article, the adipose hypothesis, and then taking the immuno piece and their link and coming with the precision medicine-based approach is heading and targeting the right patient, the right time, with the right level of immunomodulation. And we as pharmacists are going to be critical in this, either developing research, identifying patients, doing implementation. And so that's why you should definitely care about this. So anyways, these are two involving spaces. I hope this was good and you'll dive into the articles. We'll put them down there. For pharmacists, this means getting comfortable with interpreting these two concepts, putting them into practice, following along with the updated data and participating in the care of these patients. It's an exciting and evolving world in cardiology and one that for the next decade of prevention and heart failure management are going to be key. So as always, thank you for listening for the Telltale Heart, the Cardiovascular Digest. We look forward to serving you in our future episodes that we have coming. Please like, subscribe, provide comment, let me know what you like to see. If you enjoyed this conversation or this topic, please share it with your colleagues and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. And I'm Craig Beavers. As we see you next time, we continue to decode the pulse of cardiovascular silence, one beat at a time. Thank you. Have a good one.